I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Conrad Black joins me again. He has just published a pretty big book, a pretty good look at Canadian history. In Rise to Greatness, a History of Canada from the Vikings to the Present, he gives us hundreds of years of history. It's a good time to look at Canada's past, as the author claims. Only through understanding the past can we reveal the future. I'll get Conrad Black to tell us about why this book and why now, the great leaders he feels shaped the country throughout its history, and those qualities that yield great leadership, as well as where he feels the country is headed. I'll also get him to reflect on what he might view in terms of a change in attitude from Canada and Canadians. Conrad Black's biographies of Maurice Duplessis, Franklin Roosevelt, and Richard Nixon were critical hits. His memoirs, A Life in Progress and Matter of Principle, were bestsellers, as was his most recent book, Flight of the Eagle, which was a strategic history of America. He is a financier and columnist for the National Post, which he founded, and the National Review Online. The website for more is at conradmblack.com. He lives in Toronto and joined me last week while in Vancouver to promote this new book, which is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Conrad Black. Lord Black, good morning. Thanks for joining us. So, as I told you before we started, this is a really interesting and engaging book. It seemed like a good time to write this, so I'm curious to know what, I guess, inspired you to take on Canada as a subject for a book.
Well, you know, as you kindly referred to, I wrote my strategic history of the U.S., published last year, and while there was a vast literature in U.S. history, it had not, as Henry Kissinger wrote in his foreword, it had not been approached from precisely this perspective before. And once I got well in on that, I started thinking about other countries that I know something about and what the state of the historical writing on them is. And I felt that the situation in Canada had changed decisively since the last time there'd been a serious one-volume history of the book of the country, because the separatist threat in Quebec, which was, whether it was perceived in Vancouver to be so or not, was a very serious threat for a long time, has effectively collapsed unless the Federalist side completely misplays its hand. And in addition, for a variety of reasons, I think the correlation of self-confidence between Canada and the United States has altered in the last 15 years somewhat in Canada's favor. The stable performance of this country during the financial crisis starting in 2008 and the problems the United States has had with almost its entire ground forces, conventional military capability, mired in the Middle East for over a decade in wars that it's not clear, while the United States certainly did well militarily, it's not clear that it strategically it extracted much benefit from them. And there is a good deal of evidence that Canada is, at this point, a better and more efficiently governed country than the United States. Now, that's not an anti-American statement. All countries fluctuate. We all have our ups and downs. But Canadians, in practice, have been conditioned for the whole history of the country to feeling very keenly the imminent contiguity of this overwhelmingly energetic and powerful country. And that has had a psychological impact on the Canadian national personality. And I think that what I described a moment ago is the alteration and the correlation of self-confidence between the two. Not an upheaval, not all of a sudden Canada's a more confident place in the United States, but just a change in the imbalance in that area, as well as the evaporation, in effect, of the separatist threat in Quebec gave us, for the first time, a chance in Canada to start from a clean slate instead of reacting to threats that made our national status ambiguous. We have the ability to sit back, not complacently, but say, we are one of the 10 or 12 most important countries in the world. What is the best thing we can do, building on what we have, to be a positive force in the world? And so therefore, I think it's an opportunity for a more spontaneous period of policymaking than we have ever had in Canada.
in terms of the change in personality, do you feel that when you are in the country, say you're walking down the street? I mean, is that something that you're keenly aware of, say?
I wouldn't put it quite so strongly as that, but in some respects, yes. As you mentioned, I'm, in fact, going around the country a bit promoting the sale of this book, and I did the same last year in respect to my book about the United States, but I did this for the first time for a book I wrote about Maurice Duplessis, the long-serving premier of Quebec, and, mm-hmm. and that was 35 years ago. And it comes to me very forcefully how much more confident, how much better looking, and much more imaginative architecturally, and in just basic urbanology, these Canadian cities have become. I mean, the manner in which Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Ottawa, Toronto, Quebec City, those ones in particular, have developed is if you have a good memory of what they were like 30 years ago, is an astonishingly remarkable level of progress and just sort of sophistication and confidence and panache, you know, just in design and the way people are dressed and the way they conduct themselves and so forth. And it's very, very encouraging. And it's of a piece with how the country itself has done, I think. And I get around Europe and until recently around the United States quite a bit, and you don't have the same level of progress other than in a couple of particular cases. And I do feel it also to a degree in the perception of Canada in the world. When as a young person I used to go abroad, nobody knew anything about Canada. They knew it was there, they knew it was a large country, but they knew it had some sort of relationship with the British and that there were some French-speaking people there, but they couldn't normally tell an English-speaking Canadian from an American from a northern state, and they weren't, you know, they thought it was probably a nice place, but they didn't know anything about it. And now it does have some personality. The Canadian flag is very distinctive, and it is a nice flag. You know, if you look at all the flags in front of the United Nations or something, the Canadian one is one of the more interesting ones. And the whole country is just gradually adding cubits to its stature all the time, and therefore I think it's time, as I say, without being chauvinistic or boastful or over-ambitious or disparaging of anybody else, I think, and we shouldn't do any of those things, I think it's quite in order for Canadians to recognize what a tremendous success the history of this country is and what a great opportunity we have. And I don't know, Joe, if you studied history in school in the Canadian school system, but I did, and apart from some of the explorers who were real swashbucklers and were presented as adventurers and were quite interesting, it was essentially just a recitation of dates and names, and it wasn't presented in a way that was particularly interesting, but it is an interesting history, and it is above all an interesting history because it's so successful. I mean, 400 years, we've gone from less than 100 Europeans milling about with the native people to one of the 10 or 12 most important countries in the world. We've, I think, in all that time, not lost more than 200 people dead in civil strife, which is an astonishing thing. We've, as an autonomous country, nearly 150 years, we've only been in four wars, and we were on the victorious side in all of them, and they were just wars, and our armed forces distinguished themselves. So not many countries, if any, can say that, you know, and we are the only transcontinental, officially bicultural, parliamentary confederation in the history of the world. And it's worked. It doesn't work perfectly, but it's worked, and we should recognize that.
In terms of the interesting people that you write about in the course of Canada's history, as you do in this book, Champlain must rank high up there in terms of
very high.
Interesting people as well, right?
Yeah, a very talented, very admirable man. I can't think of a negative thing to say about him.
And
it's just astonishing what he achieved.
And the connection to, because it's several hundred years ago, I mean, the connection from what Champlain, how he envisioned this land, I mean, we see that through to today, don't we?
I believe it. Anyway, he returned to, he crossed the ocean 33 times. He would go back to France and report first to King Henry IV and then to King Louis XIII and his great minister, Cardinal Richelieu. And he outlined to the king and to Richelieu his plan to make a great capital that he would call Ludovicus after the king, you see, in the New World, and that he would transport French civilization to the New World. That isn't exactly how it's worked out, but because it couldn't be sustained indefinitely as being French because of British superiority in the Atlantic Ocean. But he was right in his vision of great cities arising in this rich country and gradually bringing the whole country as far as it went. He didn't know how far it went. Into a national system, and it was an astounding vision, and it's been taken forward generation after generation to where we are by the French and the English and others.
We're skipping here hundreds of years because it's a vast history, obviously. But Sir John A., was he our greatest prime minister, do you think?
I believe he was. And he, as far as I can see, was the first to build on the tradition set up by Baldwin and LaFontaine that if we were going to make a country here and not just fall into the lap of the Americans, and I'm not saying that it's a terrible fate to be an American. It isn't a terrible fate, but if the objective here was to do something different and do it ourselves, that wasn't what we wanted to do. And if we were going to do it, Johnny and MacDonald saw that you had to take the formula that Baldwin and LaFontaine had of, in important questions, a double majority, a majority amongst the French and amongst the English, and you had to turn it into a confederal system where each incoming province had the same rights as a jurisdiction, but at the national level, it had to be the influence had to be distributed according to the population of each province. And that the country, because of it being just strung out along the U.S. border, would have to be bound together by a transcontinental railway, which would be an immensely ambitious undertaking. Even in the United States, it was an undertaking, but they had capital markets, they were a rich country, and they didn't have to build across the Canadian Shield. I mean, it was relatively easy going until you got to the Rocky Mountains. Here, we building it around the North Shore of Lake Superior was a very complicated thing, and we had to have a national policy in which we had some tariff protection that gave us a manufacturing industry that could survive. And he put all this through, and even after nearly 30 years of leadership in the so-called United Province and then in the Dominion of Canada, this threat came down upon him in 1885, where Louis Riel raised a rebellion, and there was a lot of talk of seeking annexation to the United States in the Prairie Provinces, and it was not felt that the British could be relied upon to go to war with the United States over that. They probably would have if it had been Ontario and Quebec that was at stake, but not relatively uninhabited prairie land. And Sir John had the Canadian Pacific Railway effectively bankrupt, which would have brought the whole country down, and he salvaged the situation with the genius step of using one problem to solve the other. He put through a refinancing of Canadian Pacific as a military and national security measure to send forces to the West to suppress a rebellion and stop an annexationist movement. And it all worked. He succeeded all the way across and was reelected twice again. And he, as I wrote in my book, even in the time when he lived, of Lincoln and Bismarck and Disraeli and Gladstone and Palmerston, he was a great statesman, even compared to them. I'm not suggesting he was as great a man as Lincoln, and he, of course, didn't have the influence of a Bismarck or a Disraeli, given that they had bigger jurisdictions, but even in their company, he was a great statesman and was seen as such by those of them that knew him, namely Palmerston and Disraeli and Gladstone and Lincoln.
the city council here in Vancouver last week declared it Louis Riel Week. In the course of writing this book, did you come to say a new assessment of him? Should he have been hanged?
No, he should not have been hanged. It was an outrage. It was the worst mistake McDonald ever made. I don't believe in the death penalty anyway, but he had not done anything to incur a death penalty, even if I believed in such a penalty, and even if he had, it was a politically disastrous thing to do. With that said, Riel himself was not as sympathetic a figure as he seemed. He seemed so because he was executed, and he shouldn't have been. And I wouldn't try and shortchange him on that count, being made the supreme sacrifice. But he was a corrupt man, and he was mad. You know, he was not a rational person much of the time, and so he wasn't, in my opinion, an exactly heroic person, but he was unjustly treated, and I certainly don't begrudge him the celebration he receives. But we shouldn't go overboard here. He wasn't a John Brown figure or something like that. He wasn't a man of absolutely pure motive and a good cause. He had legitimate grievances, but he was a peculiar and a venal.
So we've established that MacDonald is our greatest prime minister, and near the end of the book, you rank the prime ministers, I guess, the top tier, you call it, and there are four there. There's Laurier, King, and Trudeau. In terms of Trudeau, you also say in the book throughout that his record was rather poor. So what made him a great leader?
Well, he had undoubtedly great qualities of leadership. I mean, he's the one of those four that I actually knew fairly well. Obviously, the others were before my time. Mr. King died when I was 5 years old. But he was a strong leader, a galvanizing figure. He was eloquent and courageous, physically courageous and politically courageous. I think, as you mentioned, that by the usual criteria for judging leadership, he was rather mediocre. His fiscal performance was not good. I think his social programs, in my opinion, were frequently misconceived, and his foreign policy was essentially nonsense. He masqueraded as a neutralist, paid far too much attention to secondary communist leaders like Castro and Ceausescu, and indulged in completely foolish red herrings like North-South, Third Way, and his effort to promote nuclear disarmament, when what he should have done was just supported President Reagan's strategic defense initiative, which is how we got to a satisfactory end of the Cold War. But with all that said, he entered public life in 1965 to fight the separatists in Quebec, and he entered at a time when the leaders of the Bilingualism and Biculturalism Commission, André Laurendeau and Davidson Dunton, said Canada's facing the greatest crisis in its history. And that's what he came to deal with. And for that, he was promoted Minister of Justice and then elevated to the leadership of the Liberal Party and elected four times as Prime Minister. And that was what he was there for. And I lived in Quebec then. It was a terribly serious situation, and we won that battle. The country survived. The separatists were defeated. The federalists won, and we owe it to Trudeau. Others played a role, certainly, but he played by far the leading role, and in my opinion, on balance, that makes him a great prime minister. It was a tremendous crisis, and he dealt with it. And I must say that, in fairness to him, some of the fiscal problems were part of the federal solution. He was pouring money into Quebec to impress Quebecois who might otherwise have been distracted by the allure of separatism with the munificence of the federal government, and it was a justifiable strategy.
Did you think that in terms of Justin Trudeau and the attention that he's been getting, that a lot of Pierre Trudeau's record is perhaps being glossed over, even forgotten?
I think it is the tendency, and this is not at all a bad thing, that once prominent people have retired, they're remembered gradually more positively as conspicuous figures who were controversial but did their best and made a difference. And so you tend to remember the best aspects of them and not the worst, for the most part. And I think that's a good
last line of the book says that the past reveals the future. Having looked at Canada's history as you have, do you have a sense of what the next year, say, as we go into an election, might turn out to look like, or the next 5-10 years, say?
I wouldn't want to hold myself out as knowing anything more than any of your listeners would about what will happen in the next year. You don't know. But what I meant by that phrase was that we have got through 400 years, and while Canada's been, geographically it is a large and a rich territory, somewhat severe climate in places, but a large and a rich territory, so whoever lived here was going to do well. But with that said, we had to have the French here to avoid absorption by the American colonists and later the United States, and we had to have the British get control of New France, and the Americans leave the British Empire, so we would have the British protect what is now Canada from the United States, and without that protection, the United States would have taken over what was here. So we had to get our independence from the British without irritating them to the point that they traded us over to the United States for other consideration. And then once we achieved the independence, we had to get out from under the implicit intimidation, although it wasn't intended to be so, of this great, energetic, and powerful country immediately beside us. And we got through all that, and we've done it by unglamorous, patient, good faith work, spiking up to boldness and courage when necessary. And I just think that's a well-established pattern now after 400 years, and we'll go on with it. But we've now got a strong plateau to work from instead of the fragile fragments that we built the country out of. I'm using the national we, I'm not suggesting I myself had much to do with it. And so that process will go on, but it should now accelerate and get us more prominently into the councils of the world, not by being boastful or swaggering or gratuitous, but just because it is a sensible country and it is well regarded. We have a good alliance record. We're founding members of important institutions in need of reform, like the United Nations and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the International Monetary Fund. They all need reform, and Canada is in a very strong position to take a role in that, and we would be taken seriously if we did.
When you were last on for your book on the United States, I asked you what your next book was, and you said you were writing this book on Canada, and you said that it was a history that's a lot more interesting than we assume it to be. And I tend to agree, having read the book, that it is a lot more interesting than, say, it was at school. What are you working on now, by the way?
I'm actually taking a bit of a rest here, Joe. As you know, the prolonged interruption in my career caused by the persecution I endured in the United States left me without a normal job for a while, and that is the only good thing that came from that. Was that gave me a lot of time to write. But I'm now in full relaunch mode in my career, and I just don't have the time to write a big book like this anymore. So I'm actually doing a lot of reading, and I still write comment pieces, as you were kind enough to mention, in Canada and the United States and in Britain also. So I think I will take a break for a year or two, and then see what I'll do next. But I like writing books, and I will get back to it.
So did it surprise you that the history of Canada was as interesting as it is?
I hoped that I would find it so, and was determined to present it in as interesting a way as I could while being absolutely rigorous with the facts. But I was, in fact, not exactly surprised, but pleasantly reassured that I was right, that these people are very interesting. You see, Canada had to proceed, and as I said a minute ago, in a cautious way, and it wasn't a revolutionary tradition. I mean, the Americans, and it was genius that they did it, but Franklin and Washington prevailed upon the British to throw the French out of Canada, and then Franklin persuaded the French two greatest powers in the world by these colonists was an astounding feat. Well, we couldn't do it in quite that way, but we had to, as I said, we had to attract English-speaking people to join the French in what is now Canada after the British had removed France from New France, and then we had to persuade the British to help us become stronger and to protect us from the Americans, but we had to get our independence from the British while we were doing it, and then we had to balance British and American influences in this country until we could actually build a proper sovereignty of our own. It's not as dramatic, and you don't get Canadian versions of Patrick Henry saying, "Give me liberty or give me death." So you can't, it's not presentationally as easy to galvanize people with and excite them about. But it required no less skill, and we have done it just as well as the Americans followed the path I did. And when you present it that way and see how consistent and, in general, very well done it was, it is very interesting. I'm not saying that because I wrote it. I'm saying it was interesting. You just have to put it out that way.
Well, it is a very fine achievement, this book, and it's a great read. Conrad, good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Joe.
The website for more is conradmblack.com. The book is called Rise to Greatness, A History of Canada from the Vikings to the Present. It's from McClelland and Stewart. It's author Conrad Black. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.